Well, before we dive into this story too much, I want to remind you of where we've been. Because pretty much everything up to this story in the Gospel of John has been saying, here's what you need to know if you're going to understand what comes next. I think it's pretty important, too, because this is a pretty profound sort of story, isn't it? There are all sorts of things going on. Jesus' mother has a job for Jesus. He responds in a very strange way to her. And then he does a miracle where he turns water into wine, which for some of us will make us a bit uncomfortable, and others, as we already alluded to, will get a little excited. But either way, he then ends by saying that this is the way that Jesus showed his glory to his disciples. So let me remind you of where we've been. We started off in the Gospel of John, and we read that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. There was something that itself was God existing in heaven. And then we find out that this something came down to earth and took on human flesh and revealed God to us and lived with us as God and opens a way up to God. And then we meet this person, Jesus, specifically. And John the Baptist says, Jesus is the one. He is the one who is described as coming down from God for us. Jesus is the one we have to look to, John says. He's our hope. And then Jesus himself reveals. He calls some disciples to himself. And at the end of that particular scene, he tells them that you're going to see greater things than me just having supernatural knowledge about you. You're going to see greater things than a great teacher coming among you. You're going to see me, the one on whom heaven opens and angels come down and go up, the place where heaven and earth meet. And I think the first question we probably ought to ask is, what could that possibly mean? What could it look like? What will Jesus do? Who will he be if he is the place, where heaven and earth actually meet and begin to come together and be reconciled to each other? And so as we look for the answer to that question, we find that Jesus goes to a wedding. Is that where you expect him to go? Is that what, after John has said all these high and exalted things about Jesus, this is so mundane. He goes to a wedding. Now, weddings are great. It's interesting. Once I was in I was at a pastor's retreat at ECO's National Gathering, our denomination's National Gathering, and they asked the room full of pastors, what are your favorite things to do as a pastor? And is it this? Is it that? Is it the other thing? So they said two things. They said, how many of you, your favorite thing to do is weddings? And like one hand went up out of 50 or 60. And then they said, how many of you, your favorite thing to do is funerals? And pretty much everyone else's hand went up. Like doing funerals, don't like doing weddings. Because weddings are really stressful. Have you noticed that about them? If you've been married, you know, weddings are pretty stressful. You got to plan the whole thing. You got to pull it off. And then you got to show up and make a life-changing, irrevocable sort of decision, don't you? Weddings are stressful, even though they're good. But weddings are also stressful on the rest of the family, right? Who's paying for this thing? How are we going to show up to help? Do we really approve of the person that our person is getting married to? Weddings are stressful. And that's where Jesus goes. And this wedding that Jesus goes to, it doesn't go off perfectly without a hitch. Now, there are some sorts of things that happen at weddings. You know, they go wrong and they make them fun and memorable, right? I don't know, does anyone have a... You might have a good story like that, right? This thing happened at our wedding. My favorite story that I tell about my wedding is that, I show up at the church for the rehearsal dinner. We do the whole rehearsal. I tell the story to all of the couples I counsel as well. Show up, to the rehearsal dinner. They say, you're going to be here. You're going to do these things. And I've got it all down straight. And I show up at the wedding the next day. And I remember that, okay, this is the part where I bring my mom in. So I walk her down the aisle. I give her a kiss. And I set her down. And I turn around and I realize I don't remember a single thing that the pastor told me to do for the rest of the wedding. And I think if you look on the video, you can see me stop for a minute and kind of like this way and that way, and my eyes are getting big, and eventually I kind of like stumble off toward the side somewhere, and somebody helpfully gets me through the rest of the ceremony, because I it was so much I couldn't take it all in. Those are the kinds of stories that are sort of fun to tell, right? And then there are the other kinds of stories. There are the wedding disaster stories that threaten to derail the whole thing and make it not a wonderful memory, but a painful memory. And actually, that's the moment that we have in front of us here. See, Jesus and his disciples were at the wedding, and the wine runs out. Now, something you need to know about weddings in the first century is they were one of the most important social occasions that, you know, a family would undertake. They were, you know, you would invite everybody. Sometimes entire towns, especially if it was an important family, they might invite everybody in town to come to the wedding. And they were responsible to show them a good time and have a big celebration. They were cultural events. Not only this, but these weddings, they really knew how to do it. They went on for 7 days. The reception was 7 days long. Now, you may have so many people at the wedding that you need to give them wine for 7 days. And that's a lot of wine. I'm kind of concerned that some people wouldn't survive the weddings, as a matter of fact. And in the middle of this wedding celebration, the family runs out of wine. And people are probably starting to notice, like, oh, we notice, you know, the punch bowl or whatever they used in the first century is empty. You know, sure, there's more wine coming. Maybe people were starting to get a little grumpy, right? Because you're at the wine, you're at the wedding, you're expecting to pretty much get whatever you want, whenever you want it. It's a big party, and the party starts to become more of an angry mob, right? And so Jesus' mother, Mary, it's interesting, here in the passage, she's never given her name. Jesus' mother said to Jesus, "They have no more wine." Now, we don't know exactly why Mary is compelled to go to Jesus over this. Maybe the family was a close friend. Maybe they were actually family to the people who were getting married. And so their honor would suffer. Everyone would say, oh, you know, that family of which Jesus and Mary are a part, you know, they can't put on a good wedding. They're no good. Don't go to their stuff. Maybe they would actually lose face. And remember, this was an honor-shame culture. Losing face, it's not just like you'd be embarrassed. It's that everyone would think badly of you and you would be humiliated until you were able to change that situation. Whatever it is, Mary comes up to Jesus and she says, I want you to make this your problem. And how does Jesus respond? Woman, why do you involve me? It's interesting, in the Greek, it's actually, what is this between you and I? Why do you involve me, Jesus replied. My hour is not yet come. Now, if you're a mom sitting here this morning, or a parent of any sort, you know, my children have recently discovered the question, why? You know, you remember those days, or at least you can kind of sympathize. If that hasn't been your experience, you know, like, that would be obnoxious. Every time we say, like, we need you to go get ready for bed. Why? Right? Because I don't want you to die when I kill you for not obeying me. So, no, that's not how we parent. Don't parent that way either, please. You know, everything is why. And Jesus kind of gives his mom back a why, doesn't he? Hey, Jesus, they've run out of wine. What are you going to do about it? Woman, what does that have to do with me? Yikes. But it's interesting because it sounds rude, doesn't it, when he says woman to her? But that's because we've got actually some cultural distance here. Jesus will address his mother. I was reading on this, and there is nowhere else in ancient Greek literature where a son talks to his mother in this way, by calling her woman. Only here in the Gospel of John. And it happens again at the end of the Gospel when Jesus is on the cross. And he looks toward his mother who is watching him die. And one of the apostles, we think it's probably John, was standing next to her. And Jesus says, woman, behold your son. Man, behold your mother. He says, basically, I'm dying. I can't take care of my mom. John, she's your responsibility now. When Jesus calls his mother woman, he's not saying, I don't love you, I don't care about you, or I'm angry at you. This is one of the ways that he related with her in a very positive sort of way. But he does tell his mom, there is more going on here than my family obligations. Woman, there's more going on here. As a matter of fact, this is what he says. My hour has not yet come. Now, if you're Mary, or maybe if this was Jesus' dad talking to him and you're Joseph, you might be thinking, what in the world are you talking about? I am your parent, and I'm telling you, it's your business. Your hour has come, or I will end all of your hours. But that's not how Mary responds. Because remember, Mary is the first Christian. She is the first Christ follower, and this is what she says. His mother said to the servants, do whatever he tells you. Mary is confident that even though Jesus didn't come to take care of family problems at the wedding, that Jesus' mission is big enough to encompass it somehow as well. They're in agreement at the end of the day. Jesus says, this is not really what I'm about. Mary says, I know, but I know how big your mission is, even if I don't totally understand it, and I think it can encompass what we're about to do here. Now notice, it's not because of Mary's faith in her son that Jesus goes to work. Jesus is always his own master. Jesus is always his own leader, even as he honors the people that God has put into his life to provide good things for him. And so Jesus starts to get involved. But when he says, my hour is not yet come, he's reminding us that whatever he does will be for the sake of serving his mission, and not just the immediate need. And he's obnoxious like that, isn't he? He reaches into our lives, even today. And we offer him all these prayers. You know, Jesus, I need your help here. I got this problem at work. I got this problem at home. You know, I have this problem with my health. Whatever it is, we reach out to Jesus and we ask for his help. Or maybe we didn't even reach out in the first place. We're happily living our own lives, watching the Seahawks, and Jesus says, I want you to be about something bigger right now. You say, God, I'm watching the Seahawks. He says, if you can't do that serving me, then turn it off. He interferes all the time, doesn't he? Who does he think he is to take our needs, our wants, our desires, our time, and tell us what to do about them? Guys, didn't you read the first part of the Gospel of John? This is who he says he is. I am your God. I show you who God is and what he wants from you. I have come to live with you, to share life with you, which means that it's not outside of my purview. It's mine as well. I have come to open up a way to God for you. You, if you want hope, have to look to me. It doesn't come from any other place. I am the one through whom you will see God at work in the world. I have the authority, Jesus tells us, when we say, hey, you know, what I'd really like is for you to heal this problem I got with my body. And Jesus comes back and says, I'm going to do it my way. You say, no, really, it hurts. Please do it now. No. I'll take care of your body. I will. This is what God says to us. I'll take care of your body. But you may have to wait. You may have to wait till tomorrow, or next week, or next month. You may have to wait until you die and I give you a new body. I will take care of it, but I'm not just going to do it to take the pain away. Your life is about more than that. There's this horrible passage in the Bible, in the book of James. It haunts me. James chapter 1, verses 2 to 4. Well, I've got it memorized, so I won't turn there. Said, when trials come in your life, Don't despair, but consider it a cause for joy. Because the testing of your faith develops perseverance. And perseverance, when it goes all the way, will make you mature and complete. See, when our bodies are broken, when our hearts are broken, when we say, God, I need you to do this, and he goes off on something else instead, he's telling us, I have a vision for who I am building you into. And it's more than you see, and it's more than you know. Sometimes it's contrary to what you want, but that doesn't make me wrong, and it doesn't make it bad. Just the opposite. I'm going to make you exactly who I intend for you to be so I can accomplish what I want to do in the world. He is an interfering God. And he doesn't let us go off and make our own plans. Or if we do, he'll show us what those were worth in the first place. He brings us back around. There's some good news in this, isn't there? Because on the one hand, we want God to make it stop hurting right away, don't we? We want God to take care of it all. We want God to make it easy. Remember those old Staples commercials? I know these things because I watch too much TV. They had the easy button. Some of you bought the easy button. You put it on your desk because we all wish there was an easy button to life. And isn't that how we approach prayer? Prayer is supposed to be God's great easy button to make everything easy. God says that's never what it was in the first place. Prayer is to make you holy, just like everything else. So sometimes it means God saying no to us so he can say yes to something better. How do I know that he would say yes to something better? Well, here's why. Let's continue in the story. His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Nearby stood 6 stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. 6 jars up to 180 gallons. You want to go to this party, don't you? And Jesus said to the servants, "Fill them with water so that they are full to the brim." And then he told them, "Draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." Something amazing about this story. You know, if you were making up stories about a really powerful person, wouldn't you make it spectacular when they did miracles? But how understated is this? Fill some jars with water, draw it out, have them taste it. You know, if I was making this up, if I was writing it, it'd be something like, "And then Jesus prayed a great holy prayer, right? And God heard him, and he said, 'Jesus, I have heard you.' And the water fountained out of the buckets, you know, the stone jars, and it was purple because it was wine, and then it came back in, and, you know, he took it." That's not how they tell the story. They just said, "This is just how it happened. We were there. We saw it." Take the ladle full of whatever it is to the master of the feast. And he tastes it and he says, "Wow, this is the best wine." Most of the time, people will give people the good stuff until they get drunk. But now you're bringing out the best stuff of all. Jesus isn't telling us how we should do our parties, like good wine, you know, mediocre wine, then good wine again. But he's telling us something about the kind of life that he brings to people. You need to hear from the book of Amos, this particular passage in Amos chapter 9, verse 13. "The days are coming, declares the Lord, when the reaper will be overtaken by the plowman and the planter by the one treading grapes, and new wine will drip from the mountains and flow from all the hills, and I will bring my people Israel back from exile, back from the place that hurts." Jesus is telling everyone by turning the water to wine that God's promises are coming true in him. But there's something else that we need to see here, because what kind of jars were they that Jesus filled up with water? They weren't just any jars. Did you catch it? "Nearby stood 6 stone water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing." See, in order to be clean before God, when you came into the feast, they'd have these jars and they'd pour a little bit of water, clean water, pure water on you, ritual water that's been blessed. And you would clean your hands, and then you'd be clean as a person to come in and celebrate what God was doing in the lives of these people. And see what Jesus is saying by choosing these jars in particular is that God gave you good things in the past. See, the Jews didn't see the law as something that was restrictive and horrible that they had to put up with in order to know God. That word that we translate as law is the Hebrew word Torah, and it actually means wisdom. It's God's wisdom for good and godly living. It was a gift. The longest psalm, the longest song of praise in all the Bible is Psalm 119. And it's all about how good God's law is. But Jesus is saying, these old containers that you've been using, this old law, this old way of doing things, man, drinking that was like water. But drinking what I'm going to give you, oh, it's like the best wine. That bottle that you've been saving all of your life for years and years, waiting for just the right moment to open. That bottle that when you go out to the restaurant, you pull out the wine list just to see what the most expensive bottle is and how much it costs, and you're never going to buy it because, you know, first of all, if you're me, you don't have any sort of taste for wine. You'd be like, tastes the same. Did this come from a box? You know, and then you'd get kicked out of the restaurant. It's the very best bottle of wine that you never thought you'd be able to afford or open. And Jesus says, when I come in and interfere in your life, what I give you will be just like that bottle of wine. The very best bottle you've ever had in your life. What Jesus did here, John goes on, what Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Jesus comes into our lives, often unbidden and unasked, and he said, this thing that you're about was really about what I want to do in the first place, whether it felt good or it felt bad. Whether you perceived it as negative or positive, I am reaching into that to make the best sort of wine. Whether we invited him or not. And that's what God's glory looks like. Reaching into the lives of people who are both willing and unwilling and giving them wine when they had been satisfied just with water.